You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 6th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Yep.
So I know you guys, did all of you hear George Frobb's April 1st edition of the Geologic Podcast?
Of course. I loved it. It blew my mind, actually.
Was,
so this is what he did. George recorded one of our shows. He took all the dialogue from one of our shows, and he inserted in his own characters. So one of his characters plays each of us. He didn't use Kara because he didn't want to put on a fake female voice and have it sound crazy.
And offend me.
So I know, you're easily offended.
So yeah, what happened is I was listening to George's show. I pretty much catch it every week. And it occurred to me, oh, cool, George is like, he's like, oh, it's the geologic guide to the universe.
The geologic guide
so it
to kind the of, universe.
Kind of unfolded itself, and I'm like, oh, so he's kind of making fun of our podcast by, you know, doing this. And then it occurred to me, no, he is recreating our podcast,
yeah,
word for word, one of our shows. And the characters that he picked for each of us, like, oddly really fit those characters well, right? Don't you agree, guys?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. I was the professor. Evan was the rabbi. Bob was Rupert McClanahan.
Yeah.
Rupert. Bob,
I really liked
perfect.
Rupert
it was perfect
lot.
As you, Bob, because he had that high-pitched Scottish accent.
High-pitched.
It was perfect for when you were exasperated.
Yeah, of course.
You know, when you got all excited and were, like,
right,
frustrated, it was perfect. And Jay was Mortimer.
Mortimer, of course.
Oh, I love Mortimer. I'm old. I love that character. It's just an old, cranky guy that always comes out with stuff that you don't expect. It's exactly how I hope I end up. It was
now
so
I'm
funny.
Having, like, total envy. I want to be a character.
No, I'll have to have George do another one and do it with you. Listen, you can get, like, Misinformation or somebody to do your voice, Kara. What was interesting, because, yeah, like, 2-3 minutes in, you realize, hey, this is actually the dialogue from one of our episodes. But it was a very surreal experience because I got to experience the SGU without listening to myself, you know?
Yeah, it's like through the looking glass.
It was. Like, it was weird.
Weird.
I, like Steve said, I had the opportunity to hear what we're kind of like with each other and detect our relationship without it being colored by the fact that it's us, right? So when you hear other voices do it, I can see things that I can't see when it's just us talking. But I asked him, where'd you get the idea, you know, because I figured there was a cool story behind it. And he said his original idea, which he had a long time ago, was that he was going to redub one of our shows and mimic us as best he could, each one of us. But then he realized it would be funnier if he used his own characters, and I think he was right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally. Definitely. He made a good call there. Good call.
That was funny. All right. Kara, you're going to start us off this week with a different sort of what's the word.
I am. So I stumbled on a really interesting article in Scientific American this week that is about a study. And this study is a linguistic study that's being performed by Tim Lomas of the University of East London. He's a psychologist.
The article, by the way, is by our friend Steve Mirsky.
Oh, you're right. That's amazing.
Hey,
I didn't even look at the byline. So sorry, Steve. Yeah, that's hilarious. And so basically he wrote about this study called Towards a Positive Cross-Cultural Lexicography, Enriching Our Emotional Landscape Through 216 Untranslatable Words Pertaining to Well-Being. So the idea here is Tim Lomas is a positive psychologist, and he is looking at this sort of well-being angle. But what really grabbed me is it's a survey of all of these words that don't have a perfect English translation, kind of like Schadenfreude, right? We all know that term. The joy you get at somebody else's pain or loss, which is pretty terrible.
That's why you're laughing. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's this great actual quote in the article, and then I'll jump into the words. The existence of untranslatable words pertaining to well-being implies that there are positive emotional states which have hitherto only been explicitly recognized by particular cultures. However, this does not mean that people in other cultures may not have had a comparable experience, yet lacking a specific term for it, such people have arguably not had the opportunity to specifically identify that particular state, which instead thus becomes another unconceptualized ripple in the ongoing flux of subjective experience. Because there is something to say about not really being able to fully kind of grasp a concept until there is a word or a phrase for it.
I agree. So
Yeah. It's really interesting how culture kind of evolves to put labels on the things that are prominent in that culture. So I pulled a few from the article that I especially love. I'm going to butcher the pronunciations of these. So take them with a grain of salt, but I'll tell you what culture they came from as well. So the first one is Iktswarpak. Iktswarpak. And Iktswarpak is an Inuit term for the anticipation one feels when waiting for someone, whereby one keeps going outside to check if they have arrived. Mm-hmm. I love this word.
Can you use that word in a sentence?
It's kind of like the Iktswarpak I felt while waiting for my pizza delivery.
Ooh.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one that's extra hard. Shimomjimo. Shimomjimo is a Georgian word for when you keep eating even though you're full because it's just so enjoyable.
I know it well. I didn't need a word for that to understand that emotion. But yep. There is a comedian. What was the name of that comedian, Jay? I forget his name.
Was that Louis C.K.?
Yeah, Louis C.K.
Who said, the meal isn't over when I'm full. It's over when I hate myself.
Jay and I use that line a lot.
It's so true. It's so true. And apparently in Georgian culture, it's called shimomjimo. So there you go. Here's another one. Gutika. Which is Swedish for waking up early to go outside and hear the birds sing.
Because you need a word for that.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And then here's a German one. Waldensamkeit, the mysterious...
World of something.
Yeah, Waldensamkeit, the mysterious and sometimes slightly creepy solitude that you experience when you're alone in the woods.
So, all right, here's my thing, though. With German, though, I don't speak German, but I know a little bit about it. Isn't it a little bit unfair? Because don't they make words by just combining other words?
Definitely.
Yes.
So
they could
make these huge words that have complex meanings.
Long.
Just
yeah,
by
they have,
combining a bunch of other words.
So it's like a
they
sentence.
They have a smart shortcut for that. It's true. It's like a sentence in a word.
Yeah.
And also, all of their nouns are capitalized, which is weird when you
yes,
try to read German. And lastly, there's a Russian term, prostor, which is a desire for spaciousness, roaming free in limitless expanses, not only physically, but creatively and spiritually.
Nice.
I got
a few.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
This one is Russian, Toska. And
Toska.
This is at least the stereotype of like a typical Russian. It is a deep and painful spiritual sensation without a real focus. It's like you have a dull ache in your soul. You're longing for something, but you don't know what.
It's like every Russian novel I've ever read.
Right. That's why it's so like typically Russian. All right. But there's my favorite one of all the ones that I came across prepping for this. Jayus, because it's almost J-Fuss, right? J-A-Y-U-S.
That's great.
Indonesian. And it means a joke so poorly told and so unfunny that one cannot help but laugh.
Oh, my
That's
God.
So perfect.
Oh, where have we heard those before?
That's almost too on the nose.
Yet we still laugh. And isn't that
Jay's not laughing, is he?
I think that's cool. I have a couple.
You're not. Convincing me of that at all.
Yeah, no, that was really cool. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So in Sweden, they have something called fika. Did you guys ever hear of this?
No.
Mm-mm. No.
It's a way, like they said, let's go have fika, and it means like let's go grab coffee, but it's like an early afternoon
tea.
Coffee.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I have a couple more. Scottish term, it's perfect. Tartle.
T-A-R.
Tartle. Tartle. T-L-E.
Like of a tartan?
Like turtle with an A. Tartle.
Yeah. Oh.
So
yeah, it's when you're late and you fart at the same time.
Yeah. Close.
It's tart and sweet at the same time?
The act of hesitating while introducing someone because you've forgotten their name.
Oh, gosh.
Oh,
that's perfect.
God.
That's amazing.
Isn't that perfect?
Oh, how embarrassing.
I used to have a trick for when I would be at parties and I didn't know people's names. Is if I was with a significant other or a friend, if I introduce them first, that meant I knew their name. But if I introduce my friend to them first, that means I have no idea what their name is. So make sure that you ask them.
That's a good point.
In front of me.
I like it. I'm so going to use that because that terrifies me. I'm terrified of that.
Oh, it's the worst. And in Hollywood, nobody remembers anybody. And so there's this unspoken rule that you never say nice to meet you at a party in Hollywood. You always say good to see you.
I do that too. That's funny.
Yeah,
I do that too because I have so many people that I've encountered. You know, like I see somebody at a skeptical conference, for example.
I do that too,
and I might have seen them 6 years ago at a previous conference. If I say nice to meet you, they go, "Oh, we've met before."
Yeah, they're so offended.
If you say nice to see you, it's non-specific, and you're not implying you haven't seen them before.
Yeah. Yet. Oh, yeah. That's you learn that one quickly.
Yeah. One more. This one is Japanese. Wabi sabi. Anybody know that?
Oh, no way. I love that word. Wabi-sabi.
Wabi-sabi. And the definition is awesome. A way of living that focuses on finding beauty within the imperfections of life and accepting peacefully the natural cycle of growth and decay.
There you go.
That's very nice, isn't it? Wabi-sabi.
It's very philosophical.
It is very philosophical. There's a ton more, but I think that's good.
It almost needs a better word. It's...
I know, it's almost comical, that word. Maybe not in Japanese culture, but to us. It's like it rhymes too much to be that profound.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on to some news items.
Whoa.
Interesting article about how much we have to increase our food production by 2050 in order to meet the demands of a growing population, but also within the context of increasing carbon dioxide and temperatures due to global warming. So this paper was done by two researchers, Stephen Long and Johan Kramjik. They say that by 2050, it is estimated that the world's human population will be 9.7 billion. So we're getting close to 10 billion.
Wow.
At 2050. And that we need to increase our food production 87%. Now that 87% includes several things. Not just linear extrapolation to increase in population, but also assuming that we want to feed everybody. So making up for current food insecurity and also including, this is now speculation, but growing food for biofuel. So if you want to feed everybody, including people who are not being sufficiently fed today with an increase in population and meet demand for biofuel, we need to increase our agricultural production 87% by 2050.
Mm. Holy, that's a tall order.
That's a tall order.
Yeah, we'll need help.
They make another very, very salient point is that it takes about 20 years from concept to farmland, right? So essentially, the ideas that we are going to need in 2050, we have to be coming up with pretty much now. You know, oof.
And our government, at least from that perspective, is not very good at long-term planning.
Yeah, but Steve, I mean, if it's just hitting the farms in 20 years, isn't that even that a little bit too late? I mean, we would need it to have it be widespread by 2050.
Well, that's why I said now, because, you know, it's like 34 years. But yeah, that's the whole point is it seems like 2050 may seem like far away, but in terms of developing new cultivars, you know, developing new crops, it's not. We really need to be working on these things right now.
Well, still, can GMO do this? Can GMO deliver?
It's gotta that's be part of the solution.
That's part of their point is that, you know, we really need GMO to be able to do this. And we'll talk about that more in just a second. But a couple other very interesting points that they brought in. One is land use. How much of the earth do you think we use to grow crops?
5%, 3%.
20%.
So you could state that in terms of the percentage of land.
Yeah.
And the percentage of arable land.
Uh-huh.
So land that you're capable of growing crops on.
Right. You're not going into the mountains.
We're getting pretty darn close to the amount of arable land.
Yeah. So we use 40% the land mass for food production.
Oh, shit.
Whoa, of the overall land mass?
And that's pretty much all of the arable land. We've already picked all the low-hanging fruit.
Oh, yep. Bad. That's
so,
bad.
So now we have to be more efficient.
I've read that. Yeah.
Efficiency is the key.
Or we cut down rainforest and plant it there.
Yeah, let's do that.
We're already doing that.
That's, yeah, but I mean, like, seriously, I mean, like, really work on that. That's not an option. So
the whole point is we don't want to cut down the rainforest.
Yes.
That's not a good solution. Yep. In fact, if anything, it'd be nice if we could grow more food on less land than what we're already using.
Right. Yeah.
Efficiency.
We need that increase.
Lab food.
That's part of it.
Yeah, but you know, sure.
That's part of it.
There's a few approaches that we could take in order to achieve these goals. Certainly increased efficiency with our current cultivars is one way to go it. Now, of course, some people argue that we need to eat less meat, especially cows, right? Because they use a lot of land and they're very inefficient. You know, growing food and then feeding it to animals and eating the animals is about, you know, 10% efficient, you know.
Wonderful.
You have to grow about 10 times as many calories for the animals as you get out of them.
But they're so tasty.
I know. That's a killer. But that, you know, that doesn't exactly translate because, you know, some of the meat that is grown by grazing on land that could not be used for crops. I couldn't come up with an exact, like, percentage. You know what I mean? But, yeah, so if we cut back on the amount of meat that we produce and mainly you graze on lands that would not otherwise be suitable for crops, that would mitigate a lot of that. There's a lot of food wastage, but it's easy to say, oh, just reduce waste. But, you know, the waste is there for a reason because it's hard to have no waste in the system. Food rots. You know what I mean? It's like, and it gets bruised. And actually John Oliver had a really good episode on this where he talked about how much food is wasted just because it's not up to the standards of like the supermarket. And the laws kind of inhibit using food that may not be marketable in charitable ways, and that we need to get more out of that food waste, you know, or
less picky.
Yeah, waste less food. But interestingly, there's a couple of GMO varieties that would help with that. Potatoes that don't bruise, apples that don't brown, you know, those that would reduce food waste if we give food better shelf life, you know, and reduce the kinds of things that would take it off of a store shelf or prevent it from ever getting there. So there's something called the CO2 fertilization effect, which means that, you know, plants breathe carbon dioxide. If you increase carbon dioxide, plants are more productive. And that certainly has been going on for the last 50 years, and that has been increasing our food production. However, the authors argue that this is not going to keep happening into the future, that at some point that that effect plateaus. And in fact, at some point, the negative effects of increasing temperature will more than offset the increasing production of increased CO2. But further, it's not just that it's being offset by increasing temperature. Plants are not adapted to the rising levels of CO2. So they're not in a position to make optimal use of it. They may have had a positive effect so far, but and this is really the bulk of their paper, and they get really technical on this, but they talk about the ratio of, say, nitrogen to carbon in the plant. And if you just keep increasing carbon, then you get a mismatch, a nutrient mismatch, and that has negative effects. Not only are you not getting the benefits of the CO2, it actually can have negative effects. Like in wheat, for example, the protein production is reduced. Some plants don't have any benefit from CO2, and others have some benefit. But so what they're talking about is using genetic modification in order to improve the efficiency of photosynthesis in our crops and to make optimal use of higher CO2 levels. So essentially genetically modify the plants to be better adapted to a world in 2050 that's going to have the CO2 levels that we'll have in 2050.
Which is something we could do with artificial selection. It would just take too long.
It would take too long.
Basically,
right.
Yeah, find the crops that are already adapted to those levels for whatever quirk of evolution, like because they have some sort of mutation that allows them to be, and find that gene and put it into these other plants.
Yeah, so I mean, we know that there are two basic kinds of photosynthetic systems in crops, C3 and C4. And like corn, for example, uses the C4 system and it's more efficient, although not in the whole plant. Whereas wheat and rice uses the less efficient. So we could get like a 30 to 50% boost in productivity just by upgrading them to the more efficient photosynthesis system. So that's there. It's just there for us to do it. We've been working on that, but that's complicated because it's not a single gene. It's a suite of genes. And we have, like, it could be 10 genes or so. We have to figure out which ones we need. And, you know, we're not quite there yet. It could take us easily 30 years before we're planting rice or wheat that has this enhanced photosynthesis, but that's when we're really going to need it, you know? And of course, there's no reason to suspect that our populations are going to peak at 2050. I think they'll probably peak at some point. That's actually an interesting question. Is the population going to naturally just keep growing, or will we reach some sort of steady state? If history is a guide, the best way to reach a steady state is to uplift poor and third world countries, you know, into, you know, more, higher standards of living, because the higher the standard of living, the lower population growth, actually.
Education and birth control.
Yeah. Or just, you know, just education and security.
And empowerment of women.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. If, you know, parents have more kids because they need them to work the farm, right. And they know that half of them are going to die.
That's right.
And so they overshoot and they have lots of kids. But if they feel secure and that their kids are probably going to survive, you know, they'll have their one or two kids and they'll be happy with that. So, you know, population should stabilize just by improving the lot in life of the people who are suffering the most on the world, which has its own good end also.
Yeah, people are living longer as well, right?
Yeah. But that's a good thing, but that also will contribute to the increasing population.
Of course, that's right. As we could take into consideration.
But Steve, quick question.
Yeah.
Little back to the food topic. Do you think it's possible that we will be having to mix in like mass prepared meals, like
soy,
you know,
green.
Liquid? Yeah, like, yeah, sure.
I mean, the thing is, the calories have to come from somewhere. How we prepare them, I don't think matters. We talked about previously that micro farming, basically insects, are going to be playing an increasing role in our food source in the future. I absolutely think that's true as well. But again, that doesn't mean you're going to be eating whole bugs, right? I think that the way that will probably manifest is in things like cricket powder. If you grind up crickets, you could make something that basically is like flour. You could bake bread out of it.
Yeah, you can buy that now.
But I mean, if that could actually replace a substantial amount of calories, you know, that people
and
are
also
eating.
Like urban farming and more kitchen farming. Like a lot of these startups are starting to develop these great little like air pods where you can grow vegetables or herbs just in your kitchen.
Like a Martian.
It's kind of foolproof. Yeah, like they have a light, they have a feeder. It's all kind of automated so that even if you have a black thumb, you can still have a food source right in your kitchen. I think that's a great – I mean, granted, that's kind of more for the haves than the have-nots, but it can definitely help.
So. Yeah, but the bottom line is like most of our calories come from just four staples, corn, wheat, rice, and soy. That's like 80% of our calories.
Wow.
From those four staples.
Do you think that's because they're subsidized, though?
I think it's just because they're easy to grow in massive amounts. That's why. Mm. Every culture has its staple crop, and then it's like supporting crops that include the nutrients that aren't included in the staple crop. Obviously, because they didn't have that, they wouldn't have survived. And I think like most of our calories come from just 20 species. You know,
wow.
So that's just the way it is. We need to optimize the efficiency of those as much as possible.
What about ocean-based food that we eat? What can we do about that? Is there a way to sort of do better in harvesting what we can from the ocean, or maybe in a more efficient fashion to make seafood more?
That's another problem. Yeah, because the problem is that's not sustainable the way we're doing it now, let alone increasing it. Farming the ocean, we've treated it as a bottomless pit, and it just isn't. And that's a too big an issue for us to do a drive-by on that. But just and we've talked about it somewhat before, but the bottom line is we have to really get serious about ocean conservation because we're overfishing. And
that is not sustainable.
But hey, like they produce that GM salmon that grows twice as fast as normal salmon, right. And people are not wanting it. They're saying they're not going to buy it. It's ridiculous.
Well, people don't even want to eat farmed fish. Like that's the other thing. It's another way to be woo-woo is to say, oh, I only want wild-caught fish, which is only okay if you're buying fish that was wild-caught sustainably.
Right.
And most people don't know. And they're like, oh, I want fresh wild-caught tuna. And it's like that is so much worse than eating farmed salmon.
Okay, very, very important topic, but you know, it's a very complicated topic as well, but I do get frustrated when anti-GMO activists say, oh, we don't need GM technology. We're making enough food now. You know, we just waste too much. I mean, it's a distribution problem. It's like, yeah, but you know, we need the GM, you know, technology to feed the earth in 20 and 30 years from now, and to keep our land use under control. You know, it's,
and they also talk about it like it's on the horizon. Like you just said, most of our staple crops are these 20 crops. Most of those crops are already GM crops.
That's true. It's true.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we are already doing it, you guys.
Right. But it is such like a first world problem kind of perspective thing. You know, it's like, you know, you got to look at the big picture, the whole world, not just I want to eat my gluten-free, organic, whatever, farm fresh food. You know, that's a nice problem to have, you know, but yeah, we nice have luxury, to actually just keep people from starving too.
That would be better.
Yeah. And also the whole, like, you know, it's bad for the environment thing. The worst thing for the environment is farming. It's massive farming. I don't care how you do it. You're using 40% of the land mass to farm that's not available for natural ecosystems. The best thing you could do for the environment is to make farming more land efficient.
Yep.
And that's why organic farming is a bad idea, and eschewing GMO is a very, very bad idea.
Here come the emails. Okay.
Yeah. Send them. Send them.
Yes.
We already got them on this issue. I'm happy to respond. Oh, yeah. You know, this is an issue, again, I feel very strongly about, because I think that within our own community of people who are generally scientifically literate and skeptical, there's so much misinformation out there. The propaganda machine has been so hard at work and is so far ahead that I get lots of emails from people. And I got to say, they're full of just misconceptions and misinformation. Easy to correct, very easy. So I'm happy to do that.
So as a side question, totally out of left field, if you could ask a genetic engineer to make one change to one fruit or vegetable that you could pick within reason, what would it be?
I like that question.
Well, I mean, the one that I would love for our major crops to be able to fix nitrogen for themselves from the atmosphere.
Ooh, that's
so imagine significantly reducing the need for nitrogen fertilizer. That would be huge.
Oh, I was thinking more like I want –
like for personal use?
I want a strawberry the size of a softball. You know, that's more what I was looking for.
You know what I want is I want things like kale and Swiss chard and really leafy greens, to not taste as bitter.
Yeah.
Like I would love a variety of – or arugula of these really nutritionally dense foods to still have all the micronutrients but to taste less bitter. I would be in heaven.
But Kara, that's
I know
what tastes bitter.
I know.
It's totally – otherwise, just eat lettuce. Right. You're just talking about turning it into lettuce.
But I feel like there's
tastes like
gotta be a way.
I know, right, Evan? Like that's what fish tastes like. That's the good shit in fish.
Gotta be a way. There's gotta be a way.
Hold your nose. Close your eyes.
I got one. This is easy. This is low hanging fruit. But I'm still dying to eat one of those freaking special bananas that Steve, you know, Steve.
Yeah.
What's the one that you and I are dying to try? The one they say it's creamy, you know?
An ice cream banana? I would like.
Oh, man, I'm dying for that.
Or even a Gros Michel.
Yeah, it'd be nice. Yep. You know what I want? At it. I want Reese's peanut butter cups to grow on trees.
Oh, yes.
I don't think any amount of genetic modification is going to take care of that.
Now that's Frankenfood. All right, let's move on. Kara, what the fuck is this next one about?
Yes. Perfect intro to a perfect story. Okay, so Scientific American article written by Pierre Cario Valdesolo this week, very new, actually just published yesterday, about a study from researchers at Marist College and the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Now, they were interested in testing the poverty of vocabulary hypothesis, which is sort of the old adage that, maybe it's not an adage, but the old folk wisdom that people who curse have limited vocabulary, that the reason that people use swear words all the time is because they can't think of better words. They can't think of more, I guess, erudite words. So they focus on these swear words. It's a sign of laziness, a lack of education, impulsiveness, and people tend to actually judge individuals who swear a lot as being less friendly, lower on socioeconomic status, less effective at their jobs, all these negative things. So these researchers were like, is it really a poverty of vocabulary issue, or is our hypothesis more, more realistic? And that hypothesis is that individuals who use a good vocabulary, individuals who are very expressive, who have a lot of words at their disposal, are actually more likely to curse because it allows them an opportunity to kind of utilize colorful language in a way that not using curse words would limit them. So their methods were simply to take groups, and this is a standard psychological assessment. So it suffers from all of the things that we often talk about when we talk about university psych studies, which is like 18 to 22 year old pool of participants, from the same socioeconomic background, all that good stuff. But they were, really careful to control for a lot of things like observer bias, experimenter bias, things like that. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to relate their word fluency with what they consider taboo words, curse words, with their word fluency in general vocabulary. And one of the tests that they used to do that is a test called the COWAT or the COWAT. I've never used this. Back when I was a psych major and I was doing a lot of research in that field, I used a lot of these types of tests, but I never came across the COWAT, so I might be pronouncing it wrong. We often like to make the acronyms into words that it, isn't there a different term for that? An acronym that is itself a word you can pronounce?
Oh, that is an acronym.
That's an acronym.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's a separate word for ones that you can't pronounce.
That you can't pronounce. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, that's called an initialism.
Initialism.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So with acronyms, we often pronounce them. But in this case, it could be COAT, COWAT. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, it's a controlled word association test. And they gave these participants this word. And it's kind of like, have you guys ever played Scattergories?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Hell yes.
Yeah, so they have a given window, like a time window, and then they give them a letter. And then it's like a free association thing. Just say as many words as you can that start with that letter. And then they can come up with a fluency score based on the number of words that they generate. Mm-hmm. You can read the study to find out some of those words because they're great. And then what they did, I love this part. How much fun would it be if you were a psych student and you volunteered to do this study? And they were like, okay, now that you finished that word fluency test, I'm going to give you 1 minute and I want you to say out loud all the curse words you can think of. And so you've got these, you know, undergraduate students just like, shit, you know, dick, like to their
I wonder how many of them did the George Carlin thing.
Yeah,
Oh, yeah. They must have. Yeah. Go through that first. So what they did is they compared the scores on the COAT to the taboo verbal fluency. And what they found was that across the board, almost completely, individuals who had a higher level of verbal fluency also had a high functional level of curse word fluency. So they are actually trying to debunk the hypothesis that it's a poverty of vocabulary situation. Problem is, as you can see, the most glaring problem of this study is that just because somebody knows all of those words doesn't mean they use them in their everyday language. And so the hypothesis that maybe people who actually have a better vocabulary are more apt to use curse words. This doesn't really say anything about that. It just says that people who are more, who know a lot of words also know a lot of curse words, which is probably true. What I do like is that, participants generated 400 different unique curse words over the course of the study. I know. Can you imagine 400 taboo words?
Nah.
I can't think of that many.
You don't need
and
that.
And I say,
many.
You don't need that.
You really don't. I mean, we're talking about efficiency in the last news item. I mean, come on, let's get efficient here.
Yeah, right? But I love that in this article, the author, the Scientific American article, not the study, the author actually says this sentence, which I think is beautiful. Swearing, it seems, can be creative, smart, and even downright lyrical, which I would agree with wholeheartedly. So I love this study. This study is a huge middle finger to all of the people my whole life who told me not to curse because it makes me look stupid. And even though I think that there's a lot more research to be done in this field, it is one step closer to me being able to say, oh, fuck you.
So there's a lot of research that I was able to find on just swearing in general, and I had read some of it over the years. Unfortunately, a lot of it is preliminary and needs to be replicated, mm-hmm. but here are some preliminary findings. So one of the findings is that when you curse, it actually reduces your perception of pain.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Oh,
yeah,
the Mythbusters actually tested that as well.
Holy shit.
Why, though? What the hell is that about?
It's a release.
It's like an outlet. Yeah.
Cathartic.
And another one, and this is something that actually has influenced the tone of this show, is that there is evidence that shows that it increases a sense of social bonding. Because when you swear in front of somebody else, it is a sign of familiarity and comfort. Tied to that, I think, is there is some, preliminary evidence that needs to be replicated that people who swear are actually more honest and open and forthright, so that they're more likely to be honest with you.
Boy, was my
swear.
Father honest. Oh, boy, was he honest.
Yeah. So maybe it's a sign that they're not holding back.
I think there's also a difference that we have to make sure that we clarify, that some people associate cursing with like anger, but we're just talking about cursing in your general language.
Could also just be a sign of humor.
Think of the dude from The Big Lebowski.
I would say, though, that this is not just a personal observation. I think it's one of those things that needs to be used judiciously. It has a little bit of an impact, an emotional, a social impact. And if you overuse it, it loses its impact.
Sure.
Oh, completely.
If you save it up for when juicy moments, then it has a much greater impact. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, an oldie but a goodie, the Dollar Shave Club.
I've told you guys before, I joined Dollar Shave Club long before we ever got the opportunity to advertise with them. The product is awesome. You know what I love about it? I have very sensitive skin, and I will literally just chuck the old blade away just on a whim. Who cares? Because they're so inexpensive. I just put a new one in anytime I'm feeling like I need to. So you never have like that, oh, I got to stretch out another week out of this old nasty blade. And my wife is freaking using my razor blade too.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Jay. I mean, can women order Dollar Shave Club?
Yeah, of course. Why not? It's razor blade's a razor blade. What do you think? Because it needs to have a pink handle in order to work on your skin?
That's so true. I appreciate that they don't put a pink handle on it.
So if you want the most amazing shave possible, take it from Jay. Use a fresh DSC Executive Blade and Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. Two reasons to join dollarshaveclub.com/skeptics today. That's dollarshaveclub.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. All right, let's move on. Bob, this is a fascinating item. This is one of the things we've been following for years, but it seems like we're one of those technologies at the tipping point, lasers as a propulsion system.
Yeah, I absolutely love this, and I really dove into it. So scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, propose a roadmap using essentially existing technology to, among other things, revolutionize space travel, culminating in extremely lightweight probes traveling at 25% the speed of light. That just blew me away. Listen to how this is going to work. So in a nutshell, the idea is to use recently developed laser technology on small to gargantuan orbital platforms to perform all sorts of useful tasks, not just relativistic space transport. This includes asteroid deflection, orbital debris management, long-range power supply. But of course, the zenith of this technology has it pushing a laser sail with a tiny probe to relativistic speeds, allowing our first steps towards interstellar exploration, taking literally decades instead of centuries or millennia. Now, this idea has been, I think, very compellingly argued by Professor Philip Lupin at UCSB. The laser sail project is referred to as DEEP-IN, and that stands for Directed Energy Propulsion for Interstellar Exploration. And he received a Phase 1 grant in 2015 from NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts, NIAC, N-I-A-C. So Lubin sees this as a gulf between these super-fast subatomic particles to the macro world. There's a gulf between those two that no human technology has approached. The ludicrous speeds, if you will, directed energy can fill some of that gulf, certainly it seems. So I think it's interesting to put into perspective how fast can we go, actually. And there's lots of ways to look at it. The fastest manned craft was Apollo 10, and that was 11 kilometers per second, or 6.8 miles per second. And the fastest vehicle ever so far, the Helios probes in the mid-70s, they reached velocities of 70 kilometers per second, or 43 miles per second. That's fast. Come on.
How fast do you think that Voyager is going now?
17.46 kilometers per second.
17. So, yeah, so, I mean, that's fast, but nothing compared to the Helios probes that are doing 70 kilometers per second.
Oh, wow.
So, but still, that's impressive. But still, if you want to use those speeds to get to the outer solar system, it's still a joke. And the nearest stars, forget it. That's beyond ridiculous. Because look at Voyager 1. It's near the edge of the heliopause, or past it at this point. It would take tens of thousands of years for it to get to Alpha Centauri. if it was actually heading in that direction. Tens of thousands of years. So that's, I mean, why would you want to send anything there? Because by the time it gets there, what's the point? So not only is the speed for chemical rockets ultimately a joke, but the fuel, one of the biggest problems with it is that the fuel you have to carry with it. I mean, it gets to the point where 90% of the fuel exists just to launch the fuel itself and not the cargo. So it's ridiculous. So the plan then would seem to be a good way around that is to do away with the onboard fuel. And that's basically what this does. But the keystone to the plan is basically the laser system. And it did not exist 10 years ago. We did not have it. And that, according to Ludin, that is the thing that really makes this like, oh, wow, we could potentially do this. He says, recent dramatic and poorly appreciated technological advancements in directed energy have made what we propose possible, though difficult. There has been a game change in directed energy technology. And it really is. It's now what it's called the phased array laser driver. And with this, you don't need one huge fracking gigawatt, terawatt, petawatt laser. What you have is a large number of relatively small kilowatt class laser amplifiers, and all of their output is phase locked, so they can kind of create one beam altogether. And these amplifiers are fed by a common seed laser. And that's it. And the key, though, the really important aspect of this is that they are completely modular. So all you need to do is just keep scaling up as large as you want, just keep building bigger and bigger. You could find utility with just 10 of these amplifiers, or put 1,000 of them and you do a hell of a lot more. So that is really important. So his idea is not to just build this gargantuan thing and start flying relativistically. He's like, start small. Inexpensively, you can create laser arrays on the ground or in balloons to start. You don't even have to jump right to the orbit, and you could still do stuff. So the progression would go something like this. You could have a 1 kilowatt, 0.1 meter array. Tiny, not huge, not really huge at all. And you could actually kind of send CubeSats. You could launch CubeSats, which are only, you know, they're tiny, 1 or 2 kilograms. That you could go up to a one megawatt, 1 meter array. And you just keep going up, a 1 megawatt, 100 meter array. And with that, you could actually deflect some asteroids. You can go up to 1 gigawatt, 1 kilometer array, which is big.
Can you go up to 1.21 gigawatt?
You can go higher.
Wait, explain the joke. Explain the joke.
Back to the Future movie, okay, 1984.
Sorry. Thanks.
And also a movie. The ultimate expression that they have vetted is the 100 gigawatt, 10 kilometer array. That's big. A 10 kilometer orbiting array. Yeah.
That's not big, Bob. That's fragging huge.
It is.
That's
but
awesome,
with that,
Bob.
But when you go to that level, then some seriously cool shit happens. That's where you can get the relativistic probes. You can get a 10,000 kilogram payload, which is like a good sized spaceship, to 1,000 kilometers per second. So we're not talking super. I mean, sure, it's not relativistic, but 1,000 kilometers per second. I mean, look at what I said about the Helios probes. They were 70 kilometers per second. This is 1,000, and you're carrying people. Wow. This is bigger than Helios. You could have long range power projection. So the high end, of course, is what really fascinates me. 70 gigawatts, 100 gigawatts. You could do things. So let's talk about relativistic probes. Now you're not going to send a spaceship at carrying people at that level, not even with a 100 gigawatt array. No. What he talks about is using a wafer scale craft with just a 1 meter sail. You don't need a huge sail. This is tiny. We're talking a gram or 2 grams, super tiny. And that's a little bit disappointing that, yeah, we're not going to be sending a huge, even a huge probe at that speed. But you can, especially as electronics are being increasingly miniaturized. It wouldn't be too difficult to design integrated optical communications and optical systems, sensors, power. Even in a gram, you could have something that could actually do some interesting stuff and report back. And so what they say that this wafer scale satellite could get to 26% of the speed of light in 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
No.
I mean, that's the
we can send data basically in DNA sequences. We could be sending stuff to like potentially inhabited parts of the universe.
I mean, yeah, you could pack a lot into, you know, 1 or 2 grams basically. Absolutely. Yeah. But how about this? So, if you did send this wafer scale satellite, it would pass Mars in 30 minutes. It would pass it would pass Voyager in 3 days. 3 days. And Alpha Centauri in 15 to 17 years. So, I mean, that's okay, the kind of thing that you could do. And if you have such a thing, now this is the goal, which, I mean, we're talking, this could be, you know, 50 years in the future to build something like this, because remember, this, we're talking 100 times the mass of the International Space Station in orbit. I mean, that's fragging huge. It's gargantuan, but it is doable. It's not beyond the possibility of what we could do in over the course of 50 years.
Yeah.
The cool thing is, if you could accelerate these things in 10 minutes, you could actually accelerate a probe, you know, every 10 to 15 minutes. So we're talking, you know, in your lifetime, they could send 1 million probes into deep space. 1 million probes in your lifetime. I think of something like,
that sounds like a lot of space junk.
It's, I mean, we're talking outside.
It's space junk that won't affect us.
It's space junk that would be incredibly spread out and rarefied. Yeah. So how about this? I didn't even know this existed, and it was so cool. We could go to the gravitational lens focus of the sun. I had never heard of that, but it's a really cool place to visit. The gravitational lens, the gravitational lens focus of the sun. We're talking 700 to 1,000 AU away, really far away.
And all I got was this stinking T-shirt.
So basically, so what you have here is, at this point, it's not a point, it's actually a line. It is the convergence of light rays from the sun. So basically, you're using the sun like a gravitational lens. And if you're at this area of space where the light from the sun is focused, and of course, like I said, it's a line, it's not a point, because you've got the farther away from the sun, you know, the less the bending. So you've got a line of this focused light. You could, if you have a 1 meter telescope out at that distance, it would basically be the equivalent of a 37 kilometer diameter telescope because of this magnification. It dim images would be literally 1 million times brighter. If you had images that bright, you could actually do a spectral analysis of an exoplanet's atmosphere looking for signs of life.
See, I mean, exactly actually, what's there.
Actually looking at the atmosphere of an exoplanet light years away. They say that some radio frequencies could potentially be amplified by a quadrillion times certain, I think, radio frequencies. You could actually do some SETI research out there trying to amplify signals from potential, you know, extraterrestrial civilizations. That's another thing. So that's another cool place you can go. You can go the Kuiper Belt. I mean, we've got one probe in there now. We could send 1,000 probes out there in a relatively brief amount of time. Get this. This was cool. With a 10-kilometer array, you could actually vaporize a 500-meter asteroid that's over 93 million miles away. You could vaporize it. Now, granted, it takes a year for that to happen, but it doesn't matter. If a 500-meter asteroid would devastate the surface of the Earth, with this thing, you could actually just get rid of it, just vaporize it. Because you're heating the surface so much that eventually it would just disappear over a year. But for larger asteroids, you could actually deflect them, and that's really fascinating because what you're doing is you're ablating the surface with this laser beam that's about 3,000 degrees Kelvin, and what it does is that heating is so extreme that it pushes the asteroid with get this, 1 million pounds of pressure. It's like putting a shuttle solid rocket booster on this asteroid and igniting it, and you would have 1 million pounds of pressure. That's a lot more than what any gravity tractor could do, or some people are talking about putting small ion engines on the asteroid. You just hit it with a laser, and that laser gets there at the speed of light. You don't have to send a mission there. You just send the laser beam at the speed of light, and you could divert something as big as a huge asteroid.
When can we do it? Come on.
You said 50 years, right?
You could start these programs now. Like I said, it's a graduated effort. So you could start small and get big. But to get to this high end, Jay, to get to this point where you could send probes relativistically or divert huge asteroids, I mean, decades, many decades to get there. And that actually leads nicely into what the problems are. this certainly sounds feasible to me and a lot of people, but of course there's some gotchas here and there. First off, and it should be obvious to many of you, is how do you slow down?
That's
a problem. But you could build a hybrid craft that you could accelerate that does have some guidance and has some onboard fuel so it can decelerate itself. So that would be...
You can't put lasers in the other direction.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Sweet.
Or you would need to build a similar system, say, at Mars, which, of course, you know, would be another immense engineering effort. But, yeah, if you built one at Mars, then you could get there really fast and slow down really fast as
like
well.
Highway.
And so also robotic assembly. Building something like this in orbit is of course, an amazingly huge engineering effort, and we don't have the technology quite yet to be able to do something like that. So robotic assembly would have to really get up to snuff, and that will happen. That is happening, and it will get just better and better. Also, and this one's kind of important. Yeah, we're putting a 70 gigawatt orbital laser array in orbit, but no, don't worry, this is just for science. Lots of people would be
no
freaked
evil
out.
Applications.
Yeah, that's clearly a problem. So I think since this would have to be a multinational effort anyway, I think that would help make people feel calm about it. But
somewhat
having something that could devastate the surface of Earth is scary. But that's something that you know we'd have to deal with.
Yeah, don't worry about this orbital death ray.
Yeah, that's right. We should have really renamed it, but man.
Right. So. So that's pretty much all I got. So this was a really interesting story to research. I think it's fascinating. I think just for the potential of the asteroid deflection.
How about this, Bob? You could build the really big one on the far side of the moon.
Yeah.
So it could never be aimed at the Earth.
Oh, yep. Perfect.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right. Last week, I played this sound. So what is that? Talk to me. What do you got?
Sounds astronomical.
Yeah, something spacey.
Something huge.
Okay. Or launchy. Launchy or spacey.
Not bad.
Sputnik.
Oh, that's not bad. Not bad, guys. Okay, so what that actually is, this has probably been recorded in many different ways, but in this instance, the U.S. Air Force Space Surveillance Radar in Texas recorded echoes of a meteor.
Cool.
Right, that's so the... Cool. They passed over the monitoring facility. This is really cool, right? So let's take a listen again, and you'll hear two different sounds. So what you're hearing, other than my daughter, is the first sound is the meteor itself passing, and then that whew, you know, that yeah, whiny whistling noise at the end. That's the ionized trail in the atmosphere that's being modulated. It modulates a radio frequency. That ionized trail does that to the radio frequency, and they can pick it up. It's detectable. So pretty awesome. Yeah. So this was correctly guessed by a listener named Corey C. And Corey nailed it, which was fantastic. And not the worst guess, just another guess. I thought it was interesting. Actually, a listener named Dan Dugan said it's a whale's sonar. And I thought that was pretty cool. Interesting guess. So good job on that one. Corey, I have a new noisy this week. And the noisy is this. Identify this. Give me as much information about this as you can. Now, people have been sending me in more noisies that they've encountered. Please continue to send me noisies because I'm very critical on what gets sent in. But I pick the best ones, and that's what makes the show fun. So please do it. That helps a lot. And send in your guesses to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay. All right. We have a name that logical fallacy this week. This one comes from Martin. And Martin writes, "Hi, guys, big fan, et cetera, et cetera." We'll allow him to just et cetera his way through the fawning. "I was wondering if you could talk on the show about something I think is kind of a fallacy, but I'm not sure. If I predict that, for example, it will rain tomorrow morning, then come midday morning, I'll know if my prediction was right or wrong. On the other hand, if I predict there is a 20% chance of rain tomorrow, then I am correct whether it rains or not. because we can never repeat the experiment, so the actual probability I gave it is meaningless. Is it a fallacy to predict a chance for something to occur if that experiment can only ever happen once? Other examples would be websites like 538 predicting Sanders has a 17% chance of winning the primary. Regardless of the result, unless something extremely unexpected happens, they could say, see, told you that he had a chance of it happening. Or a chiropractor telling me that fixing a subluxation will have only a 1 in 3 chance of curing my headache. Cheers, Martin. Yeah, that's a good question. There's a big if you got in there, that if the experiment could only ever happen once. So obviously, if somebody says, you know, 100% something's going to happen or not going to happen, then you just need that one example in order to either verify or falsify their prediction. But whenever you give a probability for it, you can't really ever say how accurate your probability was from a single example. But you can if you collate over time your predictions and how often they're correct. That's what you'd have to do. So, like,
using the same methodology.
Well, right.
Or just, yeah, for example, when you give something a 20% chance of happening, how many times does it happen? Does it happen 20% of the time, or does it happen 40% of the time, which means you're underestimating by half, or does it happen only 5% of the time? So that's the only really meaningful analysis that you could do. In fact, psychologists do this in psychological studies. They ask people to estimate how confident they are in an answer to a question. If people say they're 90% confident, then they should be correct 9 out of 10 times. They say that. In fact, they're not. That's the overconfidence effect. I know we talked about it on the show before. People tend to overestimate their own skills and knowledge. Yeah. Well, Dunning-Kruger is the inability to accurately assess your ability, but there's also an overconfidence effect where we tend to overshoot. So that's how they do it. You have to do it with multiple trials. So I don't think there's a fallacy there. It's not a fallacy, certainly, to give a percentage estimate of something. I mean, I do that all the time as a physician. It's a probability game. You know, we give a differential diagnosis and some kind of rough estimate of what we think is likely or unlikely. Sometimes the 5%, I tell this to my residents and my students all the time, you can figure out what the 95% answer is, and you should be right 95% of the time, but 5% of the time, it's going to be the 5% answer, you know? It sounds very rare, but it's 1 in 20, which for me is every day. You know, I'm going to see, if I make 20 diagnoses a day, one of them is going to have the 5% answer. But how do you know how accurate you are? You know, you have to do statistics over multiple trials.
Which people are inherently very bad at.
Yeah, that's where confirmation bias comes in. You know, again, reinforces the overconfidence effect. We remember every time we were correct. Or even if you weren't correct, you go, oh, that was my next choice, or I knew it was that one. I had a feeling, you know.
Yeah, science. We do that every week with science.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think it's more of a cognitive bias that you're talking about, kind of talking around. I don't think that it's inherently a fallacy to make a prediction. Of course, if it's a one-off, it's not a fallacy. It's just that you'll never know how accurate your prediction was. That is correct. Only do it when you have multiple samples. We're going to do one email. This is an interesting follow-up. You may remember that back in the early days of the SGU, our most prestigious interview was with President Jimmy Carter. This was arranged by his grandson, Josh Carter, who's a friend of the show. And one of the things we talked to President Carter about was about his experience seeing a UFO, an unidentified flying object. He's obviously been cited as a credible source, seeing a UFO as if this means, you know, we're being visited by aliens. And we wanted to get, you know, his firsthand account of what he saw. Now, one of the hypotheses is that President Carter might have seen a halo around Venus, although he insisted that that's not what he was looking at. But that would have been in roughly the right place and altitude, et cetera, and time of day. And even though he may know what Venus looks like, a halo around Venus is an unusual phenomenon that you may not be familiar with, and that he roughly described a ball of gas or a glowing kind of blob. But then he said it changed color and it moved, so it didn't quite fit with that. But, you know, memory and perception being what it is, who knows, right? So I wasn't willing to dismiss that hypothesis. Clearly, it wasn't an alien spacecraft, but he's never claimed that either.
No. But his claim has been bantered by UFO enthusiasts who basically twist it to their own ends and saying, oh, Jimmy Carter says he saw a UFO.
Right. So we got a recent email from Josh Carter, but very nicely, you know, summarizing some recent communications that they had. I can't read the whole thing because it's very long, but we'll have it in the show notes. Josh essentially writes to convey that, ever since, he and his brothers and sisters were children, they would, sit on their granddad's knee and he would tell them the interesting stories, including the time that he saw a UFO. And he says, I saw a UFO. But of course, by UFO, he meant unidentified flying object, not flying saucer. He didn't know what it was. It remains unidentified. He did look into it briefly to see if he could figure out if there was anything that might explain it. In the location where he was in Georgia at the time, he was not too far from an Air Force base, Eglin Air Force Base. And he called them and said, hey, did you launch anything, that night? And that might explain it, but they weren't able to give him any useful information. Well, now they received an email, or Jimmy Carter received an email that he forwarded to his family, including Josh, who nicely forwarded it to us. This comes from a former professor at Georgia Tech, longtime admirer of the president. He says that in the early 70s, he worked on an Air Force-sponsored project that studied the upper atmosphere using releases of glowing chemical clouds produced by rockets launched from Eglin Air Force Base Rockets Range in Florida. Some of these chemical clouds, notably sodium and barium, were visible by the process of resonance scattering of sunlight. Clouds of this type had to be launched not long after sunset or not long before sunrise. This was due to the fact that the cloud had to be in sunlight at high altitude while it was still dark enough at ground level for the cloud to be visible against the dark sky. So essentially, it needs to be in light, but the viewer needs to be in dark, and the only way to make that happen is to do it right around sunrise or sunset. He goes on, in Carter's official 1973 UFO report, as given in the Rhodes book, he stated that he had seen the phenomenon in October 1969 at 7:15 p.m. EST. However, it has been determined from Lions Club records that Carter must have seen the UFO when he spoke to their Leary, Georgia chapter on January 6, 1969. The report, U.S. Space Science Program Report to COSPAR 1970, documents that there was a barium cloud launched from Eglin Air Force Base, rocket number HE7.626, and released on January 6, 1969 at 7:35 p.m. EST. The reported altitude for this cloud was 152 kilometers with a distance between Leary, Georgia and Eglin Air Force Base, Florida of about 234 kilometers. This cloud would have appeared in the sky at an elevation of 33 degrees, consistent with Carter's estimate of a 30 degree elevation. Carter's report notes that stars were visible, so the night must have been clear. I can verify from personal experience that under clear skies, a barium cloud such as this would easily have been visible from the distance of Leary, Georgia. Carter reported the UFO appeared from the west. The direction of Eglin Air Force Base from Leary, Georgia is approximately west-southwest, so close enough. Thus, this barium cloud at Eglin is consistent with Carter's reported UFO as to time, elevation, and direction. Furthermore, the appearance reported by Carter is totally consistent with a high-altitude barium cloud. His report stated that it was bluish at first, then reddish, luminous, not solid. A neutral barium cloud would initially glow bluish or greenish, with parts of it taking on a reddish glow as some of the barium becomes ionized in the high-altitude sunlight. The size and brightness reported as being about that of the moon would also be consistent with a barium cloud at Eglin as viewed from Leary, Georgia. So, he goes on, but that's the essence of it. It seems that we have an alternate explanation for Carter's UFO sighting that sounds pretty darn good, gotta say. And I looked up the barium cloud thing, and yes, it's as he described. They launched these clouds to basically investigate the ionosphere, the upper atmosphere, and there are pictures of it online. If you look it up, you'll see them, and they are these glowing blobs, pretty much what President Carter described. Yeah, and also not dissimilar to a Venus halo, by the way. So you could see how the two would have a similar description. But I do think, given everything that this guy is reporting, that the barium cloud is probably a better explanation for what President Carter saw. But that's a pretty esoteric phenomenon. Again, it just goes to show the lesson here is, of course, that currently unexplained does not mean unexplainable and does not mean alien spacecraft. Just means there's a lot of weird shit happening and you don't know all of it. You know, your inability to explain something doesn't mean that there isn't a perfectly good explanation out there. And, you know, President Carter was unable to get this information for himself, but the records show that these types of things were happening at that time, and that's a good explanation. It's like a lot, there's been a rash of UFO sightings, which are probably the Chinese lanterns, the floating lanterns. If you're not aware those things exist and you see, you know, three or four of these lanterns floating in the distance,
forget it.
You'll be hard pressed to explain what it is you're looking at, and it could seem very eerie, but again, it doesn't mean it's an alien spacecraft. So anyway, thank you, Josh, for sending that on to us so that we could update that story. I think this one is solved. Mm. Of course, there's no way to definitively prove that that's what he saw. There's no video evidence or recording. We just have his account, but his contemporary account is perfectly consistent with the barium cloud explanation. We do not need to resort to alien spacecraft to explain it. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses.
Sweet mother of pearl, you should be listening to The Great Courses right now. Do you guys want to educate yourselves and enjoy yourselves while you sit in the comfort of your own home or wherever you're carrying any kind of digital device? You could watch all these awesome classes. Kara, talk about it.
And we're not just saying that because one of our favorites happens to be one of our very own Stephen's courses. Your Deceptive Mind, a scientific guide to critical thinking skills. It's really good, you guys. You'll learn basically the handbook to skepticism by our own Stephen Novella.
Yeah, but how can I watch it? I know how. I can connect the internet to my TV and watch it there, or on my PC, or on my tablet, or on my phone. Use the Great Courses Plus apps, and you can stream from any of these sources and more.
And now the Great Courses Plus is offering you a chance to stream hundreds of their courses, including Your Deceptive Mind, a $235 value for free when you use our special URL. So go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. Bob, last week you were pretty negative about my black hole creating heavier elements thing.
Yes.
And one of our listeners wrote in to say that he thought you were being a little negative. And I pointed out to him that, well, it's kind of their job is to they know one of them is fake and they have to sort of come up with a reason why one of them is fake. So it's sort of part of the game. But he did make an interesting point.
I agree, Steve. He said Bob's a jerk. And I'm like, yeah, I'm agreeing with him.
jerk who swept your ass.
We talked about the fact that the fake item was that heavier elements can be made in the accretion disk around a black hole. But the truth is that astronomers believe that heavier elements are made in one of two places, when neutron stars collide or during supernova. And we actually had another listener who is, I think, a physicist, write in and say, actually, it's not when the stars collapse that the heavier elements are made. It's when they explode out. That outward pressure is so strong, that's where all the nucleation occurs, where heavier elements heavier than iron are made, which makes sense because they're blasting out, you know, back out into space, which so they could seed future clouds that will turn into solar systems. But he also said, the first guy said, that if a neutron star collides with a black hole, that also could generate heavier elements, or at least that's what scientists think. So it doesn't have to be two neutron stars. So my fake item was almost right. It wasn't just in an ordinary accretion disk, but it can be in one that results from a neutron star colliding with a black hole.
So you got to be careful when you make up your own fictions there.
Yeah, Steve. I got to be careful.
Now, Steve, so nucleation does not occur with the intense pressure of the collapse.
Well, is it that but turns into neutrons in a neutron star? If it's collapsing, it's in the stuff that's exploding now out, not the stuff that stays collapsed down.
Oh, wow. I got to look into that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive, but I could see what he's saying. Yeah, I do have to read more about that because that's interesting. I envisioned it happening in the collapsing down phase, but it seems it's more the outward pressure of the explosion is so great that that's where it happens. We have a theme this week, and the theme is energy. Okay? You guys ready for the energy-themed science fiction? Here we go. Item number one, scientists have developed solar cells made from inexpensive perovskite crystals. That's P-E-R-O-V-S-K-I-T-E, perovskite crystals, that are almost twice as efficient as silicon-based solar cells. Item number two, researchers announced that they have made and successfully tested a rechargeable battery that uses bacteria to store and generate electricity. And item number three, MIT scientists have devised a technique for doubling the efficiency of coal burning to produce electricity. Bob, you go first.
So scientists have developed solar cells from inexpensive perovskite, because they call that PK, right?
I don't know.
That are almost twice as efficient as silicon. You know, I can't take any of the solar photovoltaics seriously, because you read this kind of stuff all the time. And sure, something looks good, but it just doesn't quite pan out. Same with battery technology. You know, it's like, sure, I mean, it's totally believable, but the fact that this is like what we've been waiting for, isn't necessarily.
That's why I did these all together, because they kind of all have the same.
Yes.
Same weakness is that, don't we hear this all the time?
Yeah. So now we've got, rechargeable battery using bacteria. Well, bacteria can do so many wondrous things. I'm not too skeptical about that either. Yeah, I mean, can a bacterium store enough to make it worthwhile? I mean, sure, you could probably have many millions or maybe billions of them, but I just don't think we're at the point where that would be efficient enough. This last one here, doubling the efficiency of coal burning. I mean, nothing is like leaping out at me. Like, no, that's probably physically impossible, maybe. All right, I'm going to unfortunately vote against my lovely bacteria and say that one's fiction.
Bacteria is fiction. Okay.
Yeah. Mm.
Jay?
All right. This first one about the perovskite, the crystals, twice as efficient as silicon. Well, the problem I have with that is that's a lot more efficient. That's a big deal. God, I hope that one is science, because we really need some nice breakthroughs here. Very interesting. I know quite a bit about solar collection cells like this, and I'm trying to figure out like what they're doing with that. It's interesting. All right, next one here. The bacteria as a rechargeable battery. I'm just going to say sure. I'm going to go with this last one. Doubling the efficiency of burning coal. I think that we've probably spent such an enormous amount of money figuring out how to properly burn coal for fuel that I doubt that we doubled it. So that one's a fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, Jay, you made a good point. That's a lot. That's pretty, it's pretty significant. But I wouldn't be surprised if they devised the technique, putting it into scale and production's a whole other thing. I think that, I'll go with my gut and say the bacteria one will turn out to be the fiction. I think rechargeable, something with that one's wrong.
Okay, Kara.
I mean, they're all equally plausible, and they're all equally not plausible. I think I've heard of perovskite crystals.
Yeah,
already.
I have too.
Like, yeah, I feel like this is a solar cell technology that already exists.
That's what I thought.
But I do think that they haven't been mainstream, so maybe there was something keeping them from going mainstream, and maybe this is the thing that happened. The rechargeable battery to store and generate electricity using bacteria. We already have bacterial fuel cells too, at least in experimental protocol. I think that it's the rechargeable thing is probably the operative word here. And I think that could definitely be a fact. So the question is there something tricky in the perovskite crystals item? Or is it that MIT scientists actually have devised a technique for doubling the efficiency of coal burning to produce electricity? I'm going to go with Jay. Is it you that said that they've probably put so much money into this kind of research that we've pretty much sapped as much efficiency as we can out of coal. I'm going to go ahead and say that that one is the fiction for that very reason.
All right, good. So we got an even split between 2 and 3. So you all agree on 1. So we'll start there. Scientists have developed solar cells made from inexpensive perovskite crystals that are almost twice as efficient as silicon-based solar cells. You all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Oh! A reverse sweep, you bastard!
Good job, Steve.
A clean a sweep.
So what is it? Is it in the wording? What's going on here? Are they not twice as efficient?
They're not twice as efficient. They're not twice as efficient. That would, Jay, you were right. Your instinct there was right. That would be huge if they were twice as efficient. But they have, what the science item is that this is based on is that they developed a technique for getting more efficiency and more energy out of perovskite solar cells. They figured out that if they, put them under pressure, the crystalline structure gets better and they can absorb more energy. And this is researchers at Stanford working on this. But they're saying that they could get up to like the range of silicon efficiency, which is around 20%.
So what's the point? Is it cheaper?
It's
than
cheaper.
Silicon?
They're inexpensive materials.
Okay.
Yeah. And also this could have applications in LEDs and lasers and lots of other things, not just solar cells as well. So this, technology has a lot of applications. And this is a hybrid perovskite. It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
Yeah. Thank you, Jay.
hybrid. So,
and yeah, it's made from inexpensive things like, you know, lead, you know. So not it's not like platinum. You know, I always love it when I read like the solar cell efficiency, you know, made of platinum. Who cares? Like we're never going to mass produce.
How thing. Much platinum is there?
Right? Yeah, right. So anyway, yeah, this could be. I think that this is a technology that we'll be seeing in something at some point. Whether it replaces silicon in solar cells remains to be seen. But yeah, you know, getting them cheaper is just as important as getting more efficiency, actually. So let's go on to 2. Researchers announced that they have made and successfully tested a rechargeable battery that uses bacteria to store and generate energy. Evan and Jay thought this one was the fiction, and this one, of course, is science. And yes, it is rechargeable, and they actually did build it and test it. So, and you are right, Kara, we already have bacterial fuel cells, microbial fuel cells, and that's part of it, but they coupled it with a microbial electrosynthesis system. So essentially, they have bacteria at the biocathode make acetate, which then goes to the bioanode, and then the acetate is made back into energy, into electricity. So you could use electricity, store it essentially as acetate, and then convert acetate back into electricity, using bacteria at the in both of those processes. And they... In their proof of concept model, they fully charged and discharged it 15 times. So it worked well over 15 charges. It charges slowly, but the idea is like this is the kind of battery that could charge over a day long use with a solar panel and then discharge it in the evening, you know, to get the energy back out. So the whole goal here is large capacity, cheap battery, you know, storage or energy storage for renewable but not on demand energy sources like solar. So this has potential. Of course, it's a proof of concept, right, Bob? I mean, that's the thing. We read about these things all the time.
Yeah.
It's whether or not this actually has a use at some point, can be mass produced or whatever, it is still very, very unlikely, statistically speaking, but it is a very interesting concept. Let's move on to 3. MIT scientists have devised a technique for doubling the efficiency of coal burning to produce electricity. Jay and Kara thought this one was the fiction, but this is also science. And I think Evan was the one who pointed out first that, yeah, they developed the technique for it. They haven't actually done it. This is a hypothetical system. The MIT scientists developed a computer model showing that this would work. What they do, it's another hybrid system. A hybrid system, they say, could cut coal plant emissions in half, basically by doubling the amount of electricity for half the coal, therefore half the CO2. They use the gasification process, which doesn't turn coal into gasoline. It just releases gases from the coal, and then they burn those gases. And by doing that, you could get by their computer models, you can get twice as much energy out of the same amount of coal and therefore basically reduce the amount of pollution in half, including CO2 release. So the next step is to now build an actual working prototype, which could take a few years. Not something small, like an actual, you know, the kind of thing that could produce, that you could shovel coal into and make an energy out of it. And then if that works, then they could scale it up to actual power plant level. So we're, you know, again, probably 10 to 20 mm-hmm. years before, if it works out well, if this scales up and, you know, the prototype works, et cetera, it's going to be probably 10 to 20 years before we're replacing coal plants or new plants that are being built are using this system rather than traditional system.
How about this?
Yeah.
Take all that money and all that human energy and work on a renewable energy and don't burn coal and waste that resource by using it for a fuel.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly there is an argument to be made for that. The authors argue, while that is a nice vision, the bottom line is people are burning coal. It's a cheap source of energy. China is building more coal plants every day. It's, you know, realistically, you know, you could shoot for that. Let's go totally renewable, and that would be great, and that's probably ideal. But if in the meantime we could cut coal emissions in half, that, you know, probably is a good thing too. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's probably unrealistic to say we're going to get like China to abandon all of their coal.
A little too utopian.
Yeah. The perfect is the enemy of the good, as they say.
Who said that?
I don't know. I don't know who said that first, but I use that concept all the time. People think, oh, no, we got to take only this one perfect solution, forget any imperfect solutions. Well, sometimes, you know, you got to go with the good enough. You know what I mean? Because the perfect is not attainable.
Yeah, absolutely. I use that expression all the time at work.
Yeah. It's a very practical bit of knowledge. So, interesting. It'd be interesting to see if this, you know, ever works or takes a hold, you know. That's pretty good, cutting coal emissions in half. Yeah, then if you throw in any kind of like carbon capture or, you know, the try to have like clean coal technologies combined with this, really whack back the, you know, the pollution that they produce. It's something. It's still not as good as, you know, clean energy or renewable energy, but it's something. All right, guys, nice try this week. This was a tough one.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, whatever. Yeah. Nice try.
Good job, Steve. Yes,
thank you. I don't sweep you guys that much. You know, you guys.
You're so true.
A year, so.
Whatever.
Whatever. All right, before we do the quote, we have a couple of announcements. Skeptical 2016.
Ooh.
So this conference is going to be held Sunday, May 15th in downtown Oakland. You can get full details at skepticalcon.com. Their speakers include Steve Silberman talking about his book, Neurotribes, Carolyn Porco talking about Saturn, Henry Gilbert talking about Homo erectus, and Indre Viscontis talking about neuroscience. That's a great lineup. So check it out if you're in the area. Their tickets are still on sale. Go to skepticalcon.com. And of course, if you're going to be on the East Coast, May 12th to 15th, the same weekend, if you're on the opposite end of the country, you can come to Nexus. We have a great lineup as well. Of course, not the same people that they have, because that would be hard logistically to do that. But yeah, check it out at nexus.org, necss.org. Early bird registration ends Friday, April 15th. So hurry up and get your tickets now before the prices go up. Now, Jay, you and I have one other announcement to make before we go on to the quote.
That's right. So we've been using WordPress for a while for our websites and our membership. And there's two things. One, if you are a current member and you're having a problem, please email us at – you can go to our website and send us an email through our Contact Us page. You want to select membership questions. Email me. And let me know what problem you're having, and I will help you fix it. That's number one. Number two, the SGU is looking for a WordPress expert to help us troubleshoot some issues and help us with some plugins and whatnot. We would be happy to pay someone that has the skills that we need. We just need some support. And please email us at info@theskepticsguide.org if you have the appropriate, incredibly awesome WordPress skills that we need right now.
Yeah, and seriously, I mean, we have – basic WordPress programmers, obviously, but we're finding that we really need the next level of skill to sort of troubleshoot and handle the amount of traffic that we have and the complexity that we have. So we're looking for people who are real WordPress experts, and we will pay you for your expertise. But we need to really nail down our blog posts, our website, et cetera.
It's not full-time work, right? So I'd say, someone that has, 5 to 10 hours a week, that type of thing for a little while, that would be great. And then we'll take it from there.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Here it is, this week's quote. I've discovered the one cause of all the one cause theories, a deficiency of critical thinking skills combined with an overactive imagination. And that was written by the one and only Harriet Hall, whom we all admire very much.
Full of awesome, yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. It comes from an article she wrote back in 2010, actually, titled The One True Cause of All Disease. And she speaks about the concept of how alternative practitioners tend to apply their one set of skills or remedies or applications to fix anything and everything. For example, she writes, chiropractors treat every patient with chiropractic adjustments. What if a doctor used one treatment for everything? You have pneumonia? Here's some penicillin. You have a broken leg? Here's some penicillin. You have diabetes? Here's some penicillin. Acupuncturists only know to stick needles in people. Homeopaths only know to give out ridiculously high dilutions that amount to nothing but water. Therapeutic touch practitioners only know to smooth out the wrinkles in imaginary energy fields. They are not trying to determine any underlying cause. They are just using one treatment indiscriminately.
Yep. And those are often mutually exclusive one cause theories.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything is caused by a liver fluke. Everything. Really?
Everything. Yeah. Fix it all.
Yeah.
But you got to buy my treatment or come to my clinic or do my thing. So well done, Harriet. Very well done.
Yeah. Harriet is, she writes for Science-Based Medicine, a good friend and colleague. She's actually written a lot of the really popular articles we have at Science-Based Medicine. She will pick up a topic like that and dig in and do a great job.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you have any questions about statins, she'll be happy to discuss with you. A little bit of an inside joke.
Thanks, Evan. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Right.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome, Steve.
Yes, it was a pleasure sweeping you. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.